You're listening to The Bridge. I'm David Paul. The Long Beach Razor Clam Festival starts Saturday on the Long Beach Peninsula. The annual event has grown in popularity each year for the past 3 years. Coast Community Radio's Kathleen Morgane spoke with Randy Dennis, vice president of the Dennis Company and one of the organizers of the festival, about this weekend's event.
The Long Beach Razor Clam Festival will be taking place on the Long Beach Peninsula this coming weekend, April 18th and 19th. And according to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, hundreds of thousands of diggers dig 2 or 3 million of the clams each year along the Washington coast. So this is bringing out a lot of area diggers to the beaches on the peninsula, and that does sound like a good reason for a party. But this isn't exactly a new event, is it?
No. Well, it's a new event as of 3 years ago. We brought it back. It hadn't been done since the mid-1940s, and they did it back then for about 8 years. And they had a huge fry pan that they deep-fried a lot of clams in, and they had a huge parade, and they took the fry pan all around the state promoting the Long Beach Peninsula and the Clam Festival. So about 3 years ago, we were thinking, as a store, what could we do to promote the Long Beach Peninsula area during the off-season? And what's really big for us down there is clam digging, so we started talking to our web designer down there, beachdog.com, and she said, well, let's bring back the Razor Clam Festival. And I'd never heard about the Razor Clam Festival before, so we did a lot of digging into the history about the festival, and we brought it back the first year, and the second year of last year when it was even bigger. And because we brought back the fry pan last year, mm-hmm. The city of Long Beach built us a new fry pan. And this year we added a couple more events. So it keeps on growing each year.
Okay, now you're talking about the fry pan. Now, for some people who may not have been out to the peninsula, this is not just a fry pan. This is a huge landmark out there.
It is. Yeah, it's right there in the center of town. The fry pan is standing up. It's a big black fry pan. And right next to it's the big wooden razor clam that spits every half hour on the half hour, or you can stick a quarter in it, and you can make it spit anytime you want. So they're right there together, right next to the police station. So, yeah, and then what the city did last year was they built us a brand-new stainless steel fry pan, and it's gorgeous. It has 4 burners under it that are heated with propane. In the old days, they stuck wood under it, and they just got it as hot as they could and kind of leaned it a little bit to one direction or another, so all the oil kind of pooled up, and they just kind of deep-fried the razor clams.
Now, this year, I understand that the Ilwaco culinary students will be using the new reincarnated fry pan?
Yes. Yeah, last year was the year that we brought back the fry pan, and we decided to say, what could we do with it, and how could we make it fun, and how could we involve the kids? So the Shelburne Inn and Restaurant has a culinary school program with the Ilwaco High School, and they had students that were really excited about doing a clam fritter cook-off contest last year. So we had them do the fritter cook-off, and we brought down chefs from the Seattle area from Tom Douglas's restaurants, and they're going to do that again this year at 3:30. They're going to have the fritter cook-off again, and I have 3 different chefs coming down this year to judge them, so it'll be fun. Last year, the weather was kind of nasty. A big storm blew in, but this year the weather forecast, I see nothing but sunshine, so it should be a great weekend.
It looks like it's going to be good. Now, this is 3:30 on Saturday that the fritter cook-off is going to happen.
Yeah, and then before that, we're also to start the biggest thing we like to do is teach people how to clam dig that have never clam dug before. So we always start the festival off on Saturday morning teaching people how to clam dig.
Now, you'd have to get up really early to do that part of it, right?
You do. This year the tide falls kind of early. It's going to be right there at daybreak or a little before. The low tide is right at 7 a.m. and you want to be down there about an hour and a half before. So we'll be up early giving lessons, and we have quite a few people signed up for both mornings. So, but hey, it's a lot of fun. And what we've also added this year was if you get your limited clams and don't know what to do with them, we're having a clam cleaning demo on how to clean your clams so people can learn how to clean their clams properly. So we'll be doing that down at the Port of Ilwaco at their pavilion. So that's a new event for us this year, is how to clean your clams.
Okay, that could be a very long day, but first you'll get to learn how to dig clams, you'll learn how to clean clams, you can learn how to cook the clams, so you have an entire day of it.
Oh, yeah, and we have the 2 chowder contests that start at 11 is the amateur chowder contest, which is brand new for us this year. We have 12 people that think they have the best clam chowder recipe, so they're going to participate, and they're going to be judged by Fish and Wildlife and the three judges from Tom Douglas's restaurants, and they're going to vote for the best chowder, and they'll win a big clam trophy and a $200 gift card for first place. And then from 1 till 3, we have the clam chowder taste-off with all the restaurants around from the peninsula competing to see who has the best chowder for the restaurants. And that's voted on by the general public. And again, that's at the Long Beach Elks. And you get a ton of chowder eat. You get a drink. You get vintage postcards. You get a free Thai book. Yeah, there's just all sorts of good things you get.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. Of course, clam digging is something that anybody can do. All you really need is a shovel, but you also do need a clam license, according to the state. And will you be able to get those this weekend in Long Beach or Ilwaco?
You bet. There's a lot of retail stores around town and around the peninsula that sell the clam licenses. Jack's up in Ocean Park, the Dennis Company does, a lot of the gas stations do. I know, in fact, we're open early Saturday morning at 6 a.m. just so people that haven't gotten their licenses, that got late in, maybe got into town late on Friday night, they can still stop by at 6 a.m. on Saturday and get their license and get their gear and get out on the beach and start digging.
Okay, well, thanks much, Randy. Is there anything you want to add?
No, just that there's also, besides the fritter contest, there's going to be a beer garden and live music right next to the clam fritter cook-off, so that'll go till 6 o'clock. So there's stuff going on all day from 6 a.m. till 6 p.m., so it'll be a fun day Saturday. So I hope to see everybody there. It's going to be a beautiful weekend.
Thank you very much, Randy Dennis.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Randy Dennis, one of the organizers of the Long Beach Razor Clam Festival, now in its fourth year, in Long Beach and Ilwaco, Washington. Hut-to-hut or village-to-village trekking is a popular vacation pursuit in regions as diverse as Europe, New Zealand, the Himalayas, and Vietnam. But you don't hear about it much here in the U.S. Now some hikers, businesses, and nonprofits are promoting a vision of walking holidays right here in the Northwest, in the Columbia River Gorge. But the Town Trails hiking concept clashes with some old-timers' visions for the gorge. Correspondent Tom Bonzi has this report.
In her younger years, Renee T. Cash worked as a whitewater rafting guide in Idaho and had no problem roughing it. Now she's settled down near Washougal, Washington, and has raised two kids. T. Cash still likes to get outdoors, but she prefers a bit more comfort, as other 40-somethings and boomers do too.
Folks are going, they don't want to carry this big backpack any longer. They want to be able to carry a day pack and be able to sleep in a bed at night, experience the culture of the towns, the great agritourism that we have here in the Columbia River Gorge, and the food and the beer and the wine.
T. Cash is in a position to do something to realize this vision. She's the Gorge Towns to Trails project manager at Friends of the Columbia Gorge. That nonprofit is leading the charge for a grand loop trail through the scenic area.
These communities are in the midst of reinvigorating themselves through recreational tourism and tourism as a whole.
When selling the trail vision to affected towns, T. Cash says her audiences most latch on to the prospect of more tourism dollars.
A component of Gorge Towns to Trails is just about recreation. It's also about facilitating economic development in the towns that are surrounded by these public lands.
T. Cash says town-to-town rambles with potential pauses at vineyards and viewpoints could bring a taste of Europe to the Northwest. Avid hiker and trail crew volunteer Gene Akers of Vancouver, Washington, can relate.
2 years ago, I went on a long-distance trail that was 96 miles in Scotland called the West Highland Way.
It was a supported trek with luggage transfers, stops at tea houses, and overnights in bed and breakfasts.
And this idea, this notion of learning a countryside and a culture and experiencing it in the mode that's us, just walking, to me that's personal. For me, it's spiritual as well. So I'm there. I'm present in this experience.
Akers says she can picture the same setup working in the Columbia River Gorge.
Oh, I can see that here. I can see that here. Yeah,
yeah,
see
we're
where
right
the spot
here.
Is.
I met Akers on a hillside speckled with wildflowers above the town of Lyle in the eastern half of the gorge. She was scouting possible routes for new paths along with several other Washington Trails Association members.
Yeah, we're right in that draw. And if we come across the south side of that small peak,
yep.
Then, you know, we just contour around, but then we're below.
The Lyle area is one of three priority corridors identified by Friends of the Columbia Gorge for trail building. The others are Hood River to the Dalles, Oregon, and Washougal to Stevenson on the Washington side. The full loop wrapping around the gorge is envisioned at 250-plus miles. Friends of the Gorge estimates a little less than half of that trail mileage already exists. A National Park Service survey last year found a vocal minority of gorge residents have reservations about expanded trails. Some county commissioners on the Washington side are not on board either. Skamania County Commissioner Doug McKenzie says hikers have left a poor impression in his rural neighborhood.
I've had dealings with some individuals that don't respect private property rights and have no problem trespassing.
He says outdoor enthusiasts have blocked driveways and blazed unauthorized trails. McKenzie says he's dubious about the promised economic boost. In fact, his county commission worries more that the drive to extend trails will result in private land being taken out of productive use.
And it's very important for us to protect a little bit of land that we have in our county that isn't controlled by the federal, state, and scenic.
According to the Pro Trails group, Friends of the Columbia Gorge, trail building is the easiest part. Politics and process consume much more time and effort. The trail planners estimate a full loop system wrapping around the gorge will take many decades to complete. I'm Tom Bonsey near Lyle, Washington.
TCAS said in the focus areas, the connection should be done in about 10 years. The Gorge Towns to Trails project kicked off 3.5 years ago. The first connection completed under the aegis of the project in 2013 was a 2.5-mile trail between the small town of Mosier, Oregon, and land trust property on the Mosier Plateau. Groundbreakings planned in June for a 1-mile trail segment that goes east from the Port of Camas Washougal Marina to a junction with the Washougal Dyke Trail. TCASH said this section will be the western gateway on the Washington side for the Gorge Towns to Trails vision. In some respects, Gorge Towns to Trails has its roots in another long-distance trail conceptualized more than 25 years ago. The Chinook Trail was envisioned as a 300-mile bi-state loop around the rim of the gorge. The Chinook Trails Association continues to advocate for this trail. Board member Tom Griffith of Vancouver, Washington, said the concept entails more of a backcountry experience. Gorge Towns to Trails would be more of a frontcountry urban thing. The Chinook Trails nonprofit collaborates with the Gorge Towns to Trails. TCASH observed the conceptual routes overlap in places. You're listening to The Bridge. More and more veterans are going back to school using the GI Bill to get a degree. In 2013 alone, more than 35,000 veterans in Oregon and Washington were using the education benefit to attend colleges and trade schools. With more vets on campus, schools around the country are figuring out how to help veterans succeed in the classroom. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson reports.
The Veterans Resource Center at Portland State University has already outgrown its space.
We see a lot of traffic in here, you know, anywhere from like 200 to like 700 people a month.
Ray Facundo runs the center. He says he served 3 years in the U.S. Army and deployed to Iraq twice. He points out that the GI Bill is an important recruitment tool.
A lot of people like myself joined for the GI Bill.
Facundo says that's because the post 9/11 GI Bill is so generous. The law dates back to World War II. The most recent version, passed in 2008, provides 36 months of in-state tuition, books, and a monthly housing stipend. Since then, the number of veterans using the benefit throughout the Pacific Northwest has grown. That's according to data from the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. Between 2009 and 2013, the number of veterans using the GI Bill more than doubled to 12,000 in Oregon and 25,000 in Washington. But even with the benefit, the transition from military to civilian life can be challenging.
Very typically, a service member joins when they're 18 years old. They go through their military service obligation, and then they get out. And then it's like, hey, what's the next step? You know, and transitioning can be really hard for somebody who did that.
Facundo says the transition can be even harder for students dealing with things like a traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder. Facundo was never diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury, but he spent 3 years near Army field artillery. In Iraq, Facundo says he was in convoy operations where he constantly saw explosions. He felt them rattle through his body armor. All that affected his ability to do schoolwork after his military service.
that makes a difference when you come back and you're trying to read a book for class and you're just stuck on that same sentence over and over and over again. And then the door slams or the fire, you know, the fire station across the street, the alarm goes off and suddenly you find yourself under the bed, not knowing how you got there.
Veterans undergo big adjustments when they return, says Nick Armstrong. He's the Senior Director of Research and Policy at the Institute for Veteran and Military Families at Syracuse University in New York.
Going back to school, the educational experience itself is really part of a bigger transition that the veteran is going through generally out of the military. And so higher education becomes sort of one tool for veterans to, you know, reintegrate and reacclimate to civilian life.
Armstrong says schools can help veterans adjust by providing a central location with staff to help vets with things like managing benefits. They make veterans feel welcome on campus and can help them succeed at school. Thurston Spicer knows about that firsthand. He's an Air Force veteran. Now he manages the Veterans Resource Center at Portland State University.
Having a vet to talk to about vet problems is huge. It's huge.
Spicer says he went to college in Tennessee at a school where there wasn't a Veterans Resource Center. He says anytime he had a question, he had to call the VA, which could take hours to answer a basic question. But Spicer says, having been in the military and used the GI Bill, he's able to help vets navigate the complexities of being a student.
Working here, we're able to provide a service to help all vets know what they have as far as their benefits, because their resources, what they can use to be successful in their transition from active military service to being a civilian.
Spicer says he hopes the center continues to grow and provide a sense of community as more post-9/11 veterans make the transition from military to civilian life.
I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria, KTCB in Tillamook. Here's a quick look at the weather forecast. Sunny skies today with highs 60 to 65 degrees, nighttime lows 40 to 45. Tomorrow, partly cloudy with highs again in the lower 60s, nighttime lows 40 to 45. The federal government and many states have offered car buyers incentives to venture into the electric car market, but now some states are going in a different direction. They're charging owners more. As Jessica Robinson reports, Idaho recently approved one of the country's highest fees for electric cars.
Here's the problem. States traditionally fund highways through the gas tax, but you only pay that if you buy gas. Last week, Idaho lawmakers voted to charge electric vehicle owners an extra $140 annual registration fee, which was news to Cleve Butters.
Wow. Well,
Butters lives in Twin Falls and drives a Tesla Model S electric car.
I think that everybody has to pay their share. And I think that electric vehicles are going to catch on. I love mine. And I think that the legislature did the right thing. I think that $140, I would pay way more than that.
Still, critics argue the move will be a disincentive to buyers. Butter's Tesla is one of only 184 electric vehicles registered in Idaho. I'm Jessica Robinson reporting.
Idaho's transportation package, now waiting for the governor's signature, also includes an extra annual fee of $75 for hybrid vehicles. The federal government still offers tax incentives for electric vehicles, but states are starting to worry their old model for roads funding won't cut it in a world populated by hybrid and electric vehicles. Washington's had a $100 fee on electric cars since 2013. Some lawmakers say it's time to do away with state tax breaks for buyers. Georgia's General Assembly just approved a $200 fee, the highest in the country, while also ending the state's electric vehicle tax credit. Seven states have existing or pending laws that charge electric vehicle drivers extra, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Advocates for electric cars say it's too early to pull the plug on consumer incentives. Washington State Auditor Troy Kelly is choosing to remain mostly silent about his legal troubles. Last month, federal agents searched the Democrat's home, and a grand jury subpoenaed his office. But in 2012, when Kelly was a candidate for auditor, he did address questions about his past business practices and whether he was up to date on his taxes. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins dug into the archives to remind us of what Kelly said then.
The date was September 6, 2012. That day, Troy Kelly's Republican opponent for state auditor launched a website called FactCheckTroyKelly.com. That website included links to lawsuits involving Kelly that included a number of allegations of financial and other misdeeds.
Are you losing?
That afternoon, Kelly called reporters to the back room of a restaurant in downtown Olympia to address the allegations. The press availability, as he called it, got off to a rocky start.
You bring your camera in, even though we requested you did not?
That was Kelly admonishing a TV reporter who wouldn't take no for an answer when a campaign aide said, no cameras. A heated exchange followed.
I'm worried about selective editing, that's all. If you would like to interview me after, that's fine.
Ultimately, Kelly relented and allowed the camera in. He then proceeded to suggest he was the target of a political smear campaign.
In my opinion, this is page one of the Tea Party playbook. That the same folks that in the year 2000 went after John McCain for fathering a child out of wedlock with a black woman, which is a racial issue in South Carolina. So that's my opinion.
Next, Kelly launched into a defense of his character. He noted that he's a lieutenant colonel in the Washington Army National Guard with a secret security clearance. He said he was a licensed lawyer in three states plus the District of Columbia. Records show his license in California was inactive at the time. He noted that he was about to be a featured speaker at an upcoming escrow convention.
So the allegations are absurd. If half of them were true, I wouldn't be a member of the bar or anything else.
So what were those allegations contained in hundreds of pages of legal documents? One was that Kelly had stolen a painting from his former employer in California after he was let go. At the news availability in 2012, Kelly denied he was the one pictured in a surveillance camera image of the theft.
It's not me in the photo. So someone else created the photo. Who knows why, other than to discredit me.
Asked if he was suggesting the photo had been doctored, Kelly adjusted his answer.
I don't think it's photoshopped. I don't think that's me in the photo. I'll take a look at it. I've not seen it in 13 years. But I will look at it. My recollection at the time was they thought it was something that looked very different from me.
Kelly was then asked about allegations contained in a 2010 lawsuit filed against him by one of his clients, Old Republic Title. A federal judge had summarized the allegations against Kelly in an order denying Kelly's request to seal the court records. Those allegations included misappropriation of funds, fraudulent transfers, and tax evasion. In the 2012 news availability, Kelly first went after the judge.
I can't say imagine it's political, but he had no judicial experience whatsoever. Again, I don't want to piss off a federal judge, but no experience going into this, and he was a appointment by George W. Bush.
At the time, the judge had been on the federal bench for 7 years. As to the specific allegations, Kelly took them one by one. Tax evasion.
There's been no IRS action, civil or criminal.
Fraudulent bank transfers.
The money went to a Nevada bank because that's where the holding company was.
An offshore account in Belize.
That was set up with a minimum balance by an outside attorney. When I found out about it, it was closed.
Finally, on the allegation that he misappropriated fees that should have been refunded to title company customers?
No. Whenever we collected fees, we did the work.
The press availability ended with Kelly saying he assumed he would now be audited by the IRS. Kelly did not respond to requests for comment for this story. In a previous statement, Kelly said he was puzzled by the Fed's interest in his past business dealings. He has not been charged with any crime. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
That's about all the time we have today for The Bridge, a weekly presentation of Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul. Be sure to tune in next Thursday morning for another edition of The Bridge.